If Reality Check Radio enriches your day and life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.
Good morning and welcome back to Reality Check Radio. You are with Marie here on Counterculture. Joining me now is Magat Wad. She's an entrepreneur, speaker, and visionary leader in African entrepreneurship, recognized as one of Forbes' 20 youngest power women in Africa and young global leader by the World Economic Forum. Magat has spoken at prodigious organizations like the UN, Aspen Institute, Harvard, and TED. Her work has been featured in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and she's been a popular guest on podcasts hosted by none other than the likes of Jordan Peterson and Lex Fridman. Good morning, Magat, and welcome to Counterculture. How are you?
I am very well. Thank you so much. And thanks for having me, Marie. Hope you're well.
It is a great pleasure to have you. And of course, what your bio doesn't say is you're also the author of The Heart of the Cheetah, the most incredible book that I have just finished. And I want to talk about the book. Now, I know our listeners out there would have just heard Young Global Leader, World Economic Forum, and little ears will be pricking up all over our CR land. So tell us a little bit more about your involvement in that and what you've learned from it and things that you've taken from it that helps you move forward.
For sure. So first off, what people need to know is the way that young global leaders are nominated. It has nothing to do, at least in my case, I did not apply or make myself known to them. They somehow go around and pick every year 100 global leaders that they deem that have played or will continue playing a big role in the world scene. And so somehow somebody decided that I was worthy of that accolade, I guess. And so I got the email, you know, hey, we nominated you. Do you accept it? I don't even know if you can reject it. But anyway, bottom line is one thing leading to the next. I am one of the young global leaders of the World Economic Forum. I have to say that I was quite, it was in 2011 in my case when that happened. So I was much younger than now. And I really did not also back then understand how the world kind of worked, but I understand today. It was not very clear to me that the World Economic Forum, you see, I was not back then, I was still coming from the left. And for us, you know, World Economic Forum, of course, you know, this big thing, right? And eventually my life, as you can see in the book, it very much, the book showcases the journey. And there's no other better way to call it than the intellectual journey that I went through as an adult, you know, from where I started off to where I am today, right? So in any case, back then, those alarms didn't go up in my head because I didn't know any better. But what I can tell you is once you're part of that network, then they start to have all types of events, right? It's kind of the introduction email where they kind of tell you what to expect and all the things you're going to have access to. And it is true. You get access to the world, literally. It really is access to the world. But I remember going to the first meeting. And this one was more, so what happens is there is obviously the big one at the World Economic Forum in Switzerland and all of that. But then what they have is in every major metropolitan city in the US and around the world, they have chapters where wherever you go, you get to be welcomed by your counterparts there. You're just part of this big network. And I remember the first time I went to such a gathering, I came back and I decided that was not for me. It was just not for me. It felt very top down for me. There was something that felt very formatted about it. And most importantly, I could feel that maybe here, you know, they're going to be expecting certain things from us. And I've always been this rogue personality. I don't know if they knew lots about that side of me, but on my own from that meeting, I decided to retrench. And so I never attended more meetings and I even didn't go to the big World Economic Forum, in Davos. And people are like, who does that? Well, I guess I do that. And it's just who I am. There's something that did not resonate well with me. And I didn't understand anywhere near what I understand the world to how I understand the world to work today. But already my instincts and my instinct told me once I got to that first meeting, this is not for me and beware. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of stayed, retrenched from that whole circle. It doesn't mean that I would not meet people once in a while, but I always refrained from partaking in meetings, whether chapter or the big Davos meetings to this day.
It's really interesting listening to the progression in your book, because this explanation of having read the book makes perfect sense. Now, one of the things that, and you mentioned yourself that you're quite the rogue, and that comes out loud and clear in the book. The other thing that struck me in the book was resilience. Is that resilience within you, or do you believe that that resilience came from the people around you growing up in Senegal? Where do you think that resilience came from?
You know, I'm one of those people who believe that all of us have resilience within ourselves. Some of them come to this world with it more accentuated. Some of us, you have to really search for it more. But I do believe that that kernel is in all of us. And then the difference between having it exposed, in my case, the way it is, it's just a matter of, have you had the opportunity of people, you know, cultivating that with you, helping you cultivate it in you, and ideally doing that from a very early age. So in my case, it's not only that I had the right caretakers who really worked on it, but I also had life threw so much at me, right? That eventually you die, you make it through or you die. There's just no in between sometimes. And so in my case, I would say I am sure that there was a kernel of that, you know, in me, as I am almost sure it is in almost every human being, but it needs to be fostered. And in my case, I was lucky that I had caretakers. In my case, my grandmother was the earliest caretaker that I can remember who was doing that work on me. And eventually my parents continued that, but also my life journey demanded for me to be resilient, because it was that, or I might become irrelevant in a way. And so I think those took care of my resiliency. So I'm not sure how much of that is my own doing. Let's just say I had a lot of help in becoming a resilient person.
But also too, that resiliency, as you said, those things that happened along with life. I mean, I'm a parent now, I've got teenage sons. So one of the things that worries me is that this next generation coming through, whether it be in business and life and school and whatever it is, especially in a Western canon, are not getting tested, that resiliency is not being tested. And you've had a foot in multiple camps. You know, you're from Africa, you've lived in Europe, you now live in the United States. Do you observe that with young business people and entrepreneurs coming up, that they haven't quite had the resiliency tested as much as they would have if they'd lived, say, in Africa or elsewhere?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I feel like, I'm spending half of my time in the US, the other half in Senegal, and that has its importance for, in a minute, we will get into that. But it's true, they haven't had the life for the most part that I have had. The only people that I can relate to from that standpoint in the US are the people who, like me, are first generation immigrants, right? Or children of first generation immigrants. And there I see it, because they don't have easy lives. Even though when you are in the US, you definitely have an easier life than those you left back home, for the most part. I mean, anyone who dares to say that poverty in America is the same as poverty in Africa, I'm like, check your privileges, please, again, because we have a problem here. So, yes, I have seen these, I'm seeing it all the time, these young people that have the resilience, I believe it's in all of us, but I'm not seeing it manifested in so many of them. And there, you know, I go back and I think it might ring the wrong way for people, but I totally blame the parents on this. I really do. I understand that parents, you know, everybody wants to give a child a good life. I get it. But between giving them a good life and stripping them from what they should be and could be aspiring for, I think we have to really be careful about that border between those two. And I really believe that all parents should provide their children with. Parents, especially prosperous parents, and let's face it, in most of these nations, whether it's in you know, Kiwiland in New Zealand or Australia or the US. I mean, in a lot of these developed and prosperous nations, many people are living good lives. And what I call a good life is not people who are complaining because they couldn't buy a Tesla. I'm not talking about you necessarily. I'm not talking about you being mad because you can't buy a Tesla. All you can afford is a Ford. At least you can afford a Ford. Okay. So I'm not talking about that. I feel like for the most part, most people, you know, can put food on the table. And especially in America, when you're not able to, there's all these food banks, all of these places that you can go to, but in many parts of Africa do not exist. If you can't put food on the table, unless your family and or the community can put it for you, that's a good, and by the way, that's a good thing because we have these, well, we have these mutual aid society systems that are completely private, you know, where we don't have to wait for the state because the state doesn't have the money anyway. But here, for the most part, you know, oftentimes people are able to, unless really somehow you. So it's kind of rare that you have a situation where you literally have to go dying of hunger. So in any case, I go back and I say, it's the parents. I look at the parents and like I was saying, I can understand that they would want to give the best to their kids, especially that which they did not have. But parents have to remember that at some point, there is a minimum that you should be providing the child. But beyond that, that child needs to do everything themselves. I remember a family that I knew who made it a point because they could have maids and everything, but they said, no, our children are always going to make their own bed. Our children are always going to, you know, set up their own food at the their own table, you know, like set the tables and take it off and wash the dishes, even though they could afford washing, you know, dishwashing machines, all of that stuff. So I think the more we're going to walk into this modernity that our life is, and the more I think parents are going to have to be really, really intentional about providing their kids with an environment in which they can truly experiment and put to work some of these traits that I call virtue and character, because it's really part of it. Right. So parents have to carve it out. So for me, I look around and I'm just like, it doesn't have to be this way. It doesn't have to be this way. You should not be driving around with, you know, screens in the top, in the back of, you know, the cars in, you know, in the car seats in the back, all of this digital things that you're giving to kids just so they can shut up and, you know, leave you alone. I think that parents are also going to have to come to the table and have a big come to Jesus moment with themselves and, you know, how they want to look at this. So on a nutshell, these young people and these young adults did not come to this world this way. Mm. They did not. They had as much opportunity as I did in different ways, don't take me wrong, to develop their sense of resiliency. But we, the adults, for various reasons, has stripped them of what I call the opportunity, the most crucial opportunity of developing those life skill sets. So on this one, I'm sorry, but I look to the parents and to the caretakers and to the people who serve that in the society in which these kids are coming up into.
Yeah, and of course, you know, in Western Canada, particularly a country that has, and like especially in New Zealand, it was interesting because your book, The Heart of the Cheetah, you referenced New Zealand several times in the book.
Yeah.
And it, particularly around business, and we'll talk about that more because I want to dive into business in Africa and that in a second. And I kept thinking to myself, oh, this is really interesting. She's referencing this, particularly when you talk about the degradation of us, the degradation effect that socialism especially can have on societies. I think this is really weird. And it wasn't until I got to towards the end of the book and you mentioned how you'd written the manuscript predominantly in 2020. And I thought, ah, that explains everything. Because of course we saw a massive, I mean, we've always had a strong sort of socialist or centrist bent anyway. I mean, it's how New Zealand has always been from an Anglophile parent relationship with the United Kingdom. However, in the last 3 years, seismically moved to the left, along with all the other issues that go along with it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. So that was, I thought that's rather interesting that, you know, prior to that, I thought, well, gosh, you know, businesses, we're going to talk about business, but businesses are easy to set up here, and you're right, and we talk about that in the book. But where I want to go to with this is Africa.
Mm-hmm.
I want to thank you for allowing me to see Africa through your eyes, because I've never been to Africa, so I had no understanding at all. How can you, I guess, having spent time in South America, which I have, and North America, there's a vastness there that a lot of New Zealanders don't necessarily understand. Mm-hmm. And then a diversity in Africa that, again, most Westerners don't understand. So you were able to beautifully break down so many biases and stereotypes, and you did that through the second half of the book fantastically. And one of the things that I wondered about, having read the book and read your personal journey from coming from the left, moving through to more libertarian style thinking, I mean, my thought is are Africans the original libertarians?
It feels like that to me, as a matter of fact. And what I love about, I feel like many Africans, if you were just to listen to them, not like when you start to mix up all the ideologies, who do you believe in or whatever, if you just let them talk, right? And they use words that are not contaminated yet, whether it's the word capitalism, whatever. If they just speak without any of those words, then you see that they're instinctively libertarian for the most part. And this is why, to me, if you were to ask me to put a label on myself today, I hate putting a label on myself for any reason. But if you must have me put a label on myself, the libertarian one is the only one I can come up with, or classical liberal. Or I would say, if not, you can call me a conservative with a heart or a progressive with a mind. Take your pick. It's the same for me. So, you know, so what I mean by that is I do believe that for the most part, most of us actually are good people. We're walking along, bumbling along, making it up as we're going through this thing called life. And most of us, all we want is to be able to build a good life for ourselves, a good life for our children, if we have them, for our family, for our community, beyond that, our country, and eventually for the world. I really believe that with all my heart. Does it mean that we don't have a 1% of psychopaths among us? Of course you do. We do. I'm sure of that too. But when it comes to that desire, which I think is overwhelming among us, to want to live a good, happy, healthy, productive life, then where the issue comes is in terms of how do we get there? And the reason why I say Africans are actually the original libertarian, I mean, I don't say it, you said it, and I relate to it so well, is because, you know, Africans have been used to pretty much doing everything on their own. And when I say Africans, you need to go back with me in time, at a time where it was very clear. And that time is pre-colonial time. Some people might argue, why not go to pre-slavery time? But the problem is, slavery is also part of the African journey, not just as Africans being, you know, sold as slaves, but, you know, Africans were also selling each other as slaves. So that was a trade. So, but if you go back to times before colonial times, especially, Africans were very, for many parts, we were living in tribes, right? And what you also had was tribes along very particular lines. These tribes finding a way to make kind of, to keep peace with one another. Does it mean we didn't ever had some wars? Of course we had some arguments and some wars going on. That's, you know, humans are like this everywhere. You're always going to have little wars break out here and there. But what I mean by that is even this concept of chief, we had a chief, but a chief was very different from what we understand a chief to be in modern society. The chief was just that, the person in whom we entrusted whatever it is that we had, and we could take it back at any moment. So, for example, you're part of this this tribe. Well, chief does something you don't like at 12 noon. I don't like it. I'm done with this. 12:01, I'm gone. 12:01, I'm gone. I left to go join another tribe, or I left to go start another one. That's it. You vote with your feet. You have this power of exit, which in my mind, if you don't have it, you've got no freedom. The only way you can tell you have freedom is if you have an exit, and that exit only qualifies as an exit if it's an easy. If it's an easy way, you have an easy way to exit. If you make it so difficult to exit, it's not an exit, I'm sorry. Or if it's so onerous. So you see, exit has to have all of those qualities. It needs to be easy. It needs to be not so onerous. It needs to be, you know, like you can do it. So that's what they would be doing. And the other thing had to do with this very big understanding of also of property rights, this very strong concept of property rights. I know that many anthropologists in the Western world don't get that about Africans, because, you know, if you read the book of Jomo Kenyatta in Facing Mount Kenya, Jomo Kenyatta being one of, you know, the African liberators, you know, from Kenya, you will see there's this part, and his particularity is his one, he was, I think, back then, at least, if he's not even still the only one, but at least back then, the only African being an anthropologist doing anthropology on Africans. Because otherwise, it's always other people coming out, coming in, and kind of looking at us like, you know, they're looking at us under the microscope. But Jomo Kenyatta documented very well when he's like, when the Westerners come and they say, whose land is this? We Africans said, it's ours. Because you see, it's a very communal mindset. As a society, we're very communal. We're very, you could say, we're very socialist in our social ways. But so the Westerner hears that, they see, we told you they're socialist. We told you they're communist, whatever they want to call us. And then Kenyatta says, but what they don't know is every parcel of land can be traced back to its rightful owner, whether it's this individual or that couple, or that family, or that clan, whatever, there's property rights everywhere. There's no such thing as this land belongs to, you know, like you have a land that belongs to the government or anything like that. And so that was very interesting. So from that standpoint, property rights were very much with us, very much. In terms of also trade, I mean, yeah, we traded freely. I mean, as a matter of fact, within the whole continent, we had some very sophisticated trade routes, some very ancient trade routes, right? So, and when we did not have this, and even whether we had chiefs or not, chiefs were not there to tell us what we could do, especially not in trade. So in trade, you and I, Marie, we get together and we decide what my bread is worth to you, and we barter till we settle on a price. That's very different from what came later, where from the centralized state, you have a centralized state deciding how much profit I can make off of selling bread to you, Marie, right? And therefore, and put me in jail, beat me up in public like they were doing back in the days, you know, afterwards. So yeah, from that standpoint, you could say, you had things like, you know, critarchy, which is more of this concept of the law of the judges rather than the law of the legislators. So getting you so much closer to common law, because you have to understand, power was super, super decentralized, right? And because it was super decentralized, people had to actually work together in order to make something. You could not force anything on anybody. It's later when the Westerners came, they said that the civilized way of governance is as this concept of central government as represented by the state. They're the ones who brought in this concept of state and how it works. That was not like that with us before. There, in many African traditions, the concept of court does not exist. A court would only be formed when there's something to judge. Every crime, and every crime has a price. There is no such thing as prison where people are just going to go there and rot or whatever. And if you can't pay the price for your crime, then your next in kin has to pay, maybe your family or your clan or whatever. So people had to really think twice before doing misdeeds. And the other thing is, what I loved about these courts when they had to form is that you, the defendant, me, the person who committed the crime. Who is the defendant? Is it the person who committed the crime?
The defendant is the person accused of the crime.
Accused of crime. So the defendant and the victim, right? We have to pick. We pick the judge. So you can imagine that being a judge, being elected to be a judge when there's something to judge, is something that's really, you know, oh, it's high status, right? Everybody wants to be a judge because it shows how virtuous you are. It shows how fair you are, because otherwise, how could two people who are on the opposite spectrum of, you know, incentives, in this case, both come and pick you. It means you're known to be fair, you're known to be just, you're known to be smart, all of those good things that they know that with you, they can get it. So it was a very coveted, you know, role to have when it was needed. And so people were outdoing themselves so that when such an opportunity came, they would be elected to judge the case. And so even that in itself, I find quite fascinating, right? And of course, when the judgment is rendered, both sides would agree, you don't have this appeal thing, whatever, and we move on with our lives and we're done and all of that. So yeah, so when you're saying that libertarian, you know, the OG libertarians, in so many ways, absolutely, in so many ways. And I loved how they were making things happen, but from the private standpoint. So although you say the land is ours, we think in a very communal way. We live in very social ways, meaning we live in, you know, social ways. We were not socialist. And that, I think, is wonderful. Our mutual aid societies were all, you know, private. Nobody was forcing us to create them, to buy into them, or to stay out of them, right? And so yeah, so from that standpoint, you can say a lot of that. Even this concept today, you know, I'm a big firm believer in conscious capitalism. Well, what a lot of people don't know is in many traditional societies, when you do business and you make a profit, one third of that goes back into the business, one third of that goes into the people who helped you, you know, make this happen, and another third goes to you.
See, like in this country, at least one third goes to the government in the form of tax.
There you go.
As a business, and it's heading into tax time. So, as a business owner, I get a very twitchy at this time of year. But anywho, let's not crack that nut. We'll be here all day. You have a very interesting, and you mentioned it before in terms of socialism and also colonialism in this country. We, especially after the last government for the last 3 years, we have seen, as I mentioned, a seismic shift to the left. We have our first settlers here, the Māori, and there has been, the only way I can describe it is a really strong activist class and elitist class that has been shunted forward in power, enabled by that government, and they are using the colonialism as the totem that they need to break down. But everything that they're talking about is based in critical race theory. Now, I look at what they're doing and all I see is not only socialism, but I see communism and totalitarianism. Now, you have quite a different view to many of those on the left in terms of how you view colonialism, its effects, and what were the greatest challenges for Africa during that time where people moved in and Africa started to be carved up. Tell our listeners around that, your sort of view around that, a Magat's potted history lesson of Africa through the 19th and 20th century.
Yeah, thank you. So, you know, I think from where I sit, things are not as convoluted for me as it might be for people who sit for maybe the Maoris, you know, in New Zealand, or African Americans in the US. There's a lot of noise, but for people like me, the signal is very clear. And what do I mean by that? You see, the way I look at it is very simple. Is if you want for anything to flourish, including us human beings, two key ingredients are always needed. Everything else is a nice plus, but two things are always needed. Whether it's you want a Magat to flourish, a Marie to flourish as a human being, you want your tomato plants to flourish, you want your horse to flourish, you want to have a big, beautiful tree evolving in the jungle versus that same tree becoming a bonsai tree because it's in a small pot. And I think Muhammad Yunus explained it the best. He was Nobel Prize, Peace Prize. And he said, poor people are bonsai people. And by that, what he means is that if you take a seed and you put it into the jungle where it can just grow freely, it has all everything that it needs, you know, the right exposure, the right cover, the right, you know, soil nutrients, everything, it will grow to be the most beautiful, biggest tree in that environment. That same seed, you put it into a pot, it goes nowhere. That's how he would describe poor people. And in that, him and I agree in the sense that So for the reason why I say it's very clear for me to understand why some people are left behind, right? So if you want to flourish, you need two things, like I was saying. You need that seed. In humans, you can call it, you know, what I call virtue and character. Like, does the seed have these critical characteristics for it to really later blossom and flourish as a plant, as a person, as whatever you're looking at? Does that seed have those critical characteristics? And beyond that, what is the environment that you're offering to this seed? In which soil are you planting it? Where did you make sure that you put it into a climate that's going to work for it or not? All of that stuff, right? So if you bring that back to that which causes prosperity. Prosperity, we know, so poverty is solved by prosperity. Who builds prosperity? Entrepreneurs. What do they need? An enabling business environment. So you see that combo of entrepreneur plus enabling business environment, you get to prosperity. Now, what do we mean by the entrepreneur? Well, the entrepreneur has to have those very critical skills in, you know, like the seed. The entrepreneur is the seed. Remember, we talked about the critical skills, which is like virtue and character. Well, what is virtue and character about? Virtue and character in this case is about delayed gratification, being on time. When you say you're going to do something, you do it. Having grit, having resilience, knowing and taking for a fact that life is hard and that no one owes you anything and that you are going to have to fight for everything you're going to have to get. No one owes you anything, and that you don't have it harder than anyone else, because everybody, if they tell you their stories, you'll be like, well, actually, I prefer to keep my problem. Thank you very much. That's how well distributed this whole thing is. And I don't care that you're talking to some rich kid who is the son of a billionaire or daughter of a billionaire. If you knew their problem, you would probably want to keep your poverty with all the other good stuff that you have in your life. Trust me on that. So that's needed, because without those, you are never going to be able to benefit from whatever environment I give you. So that was that seed. That entrepreneur has to have those characters. And I have no better word to bring them in besides your hard skills that maybe engineering is, if you're going to be in that field or whatever. But as a whole, there's this thing called virtue and character, you know, like built up your character. That's important if you're going to go anywhere. And then beyond that, we provide you, in addition to that, then ideally, we have a right environment for you. In this case, we call it the business environment. In this case, we call it economic freedom. This is basically the way we judge as to whether the environment you're in is an environment that allows you to enterprise or stifle your enterprising side. Does it foster and promote innovation and taking risk and being rewarded, or does it stifle innovation and the ability for you to deploy your wings? But if you have those two, usually chances are you're going to get somewhere. And then these entrepreneurs get to work. The environment is friendly for them to be able to do that work. Then they create the jobs. Those jobs mean income for other people. Those people, you know, who are working at the company, they're making this income in exchange. They go and they take care of their families, and everybody is where they want to be. And then people go as far as they want to go. They try to make much money as they want to make, or whatever it is that they fancy. Some people will not care about making millions, but just having a well-balanced, work life. And they never want to be a business person in their life. But sure, do they need the job? Yeah. And they're happy to have this great job where they're making a good income and take care of their families. So that's how this whole thing works. So for someone like me in Africa, it is clear that what we're missing the most is the environment in this equation that I told you about, the seed and the environment. What we're missing, what my book goes all about, is that we have the most rotten business climates in the world. Africa is the region in the world where entrepreneurs are the least free to enterprise. And then no wonder, if that's the case, we can't create as many of these companies we should create, which then don't create the jobs that we need to create, which then means the income that they would have provided to people is not there. And people not having this income means people are poor. And there you go, you have it. So in our case, it's very clear. It's very clear. We're not encumbered with, oh, gee, what's causing it? But then I look at the US and I look at New Zealand and I look at places like that. And you start to think about those who say that they're from a minority and want to make it sound like because they're from a minority, they're not getting anywhere. First of all, I always want to tell those people to stop the madness because I wouldn't be surprised that, I give you an example. In the US, they say, oh, black people this, black people that. Black people are suffering, black people whatever. Well, did you know that if you take out the numbers, if you out of all the black measurements, you take out African immigrants, which I am, or the immigrants from, Caribbeans, then all of a sudden, the numbers look very different. We make more money than whites. We're better educated than whites. It's a very different thing. It's when you start to add African Americans that then the averages start to go down. So then I'm sitting there thinking to myself, huh, what's going on over here? Now, it doesn't mean that all African Americans are just lousy people not doing any work and they're doing pathetically. No, there are millions of African Americans who are doing just fine in the US. Thank you very much. And just do not buy into this attitude of, oh, poor me, I'm victimized because, you know, slavery, blah, blah, blah. So then it makes you think about something else. We talked about this equation, which in my mind is very real. And so I'm starting to think maybe there's an issue somewhere at the cultural level. Because that's what if you are lucky enough to be in an environment where you, unlike me in Africa, has one of the best business environments in the world, yet you're not taking advantage of it. The only thing is, I can't really blame. Yeah, you're going to say there is a systemic racism. Or is the incarceration system, biased against black people so far, it looks like? Absolutely. Should we do something about it? You betcha. And this is also the key part. If you think there is a problem, come on, get up and do something about it. So this is why I have so much respect for people like Van Jones and other people like that, who have, and people like, Anton Lucky and people like Alice Johnson, who have rolled up their sleeves and they're literally working on the criminal justice reforms. And that's great. That's great. So those are the external factors. So you do something about that. Just don't sit there and complain and just say, oh, so do something. So these people are doing something. That's great. And we're already seeing some changes. But beyond that, okay, fine, fine. Even if I was not putting you in jail arbitrarily or unfairly, yet you're out, you're free. But you're telling me that math is racist? You're telling me that having the expectation of being on time is white? You're telling me that the ability for delayed gratification is to be white? You're telling me all of this nonsense? Well, you're the problem. Because I know that with values like that, you go nowhere in this world. I don't care which skin color you are. So this is the problem. So with this situation here, we have an issue with these characters that I was telling you about the seed. And this is, so there is an issue, especially in this case, I'm talking about black culture, black urban culture. There's an issue. Why do you have to be loving music and cultures where, using the N-word all over the place, women twerking all over the place, having baby mamas all over the place, and even speaking proper English for you is like acting white. Excuse me. We have a problem. So that's why there, it's very clear to me. Out of that equation, the seed with its critical characters, meaning like character and virtue, and the business and the environment. The environment is there, yes. There are things to clean up about that, but still, it is nothing that can really stop you because millions of other Blacks are succeeding. Thank you very much, including me as an immigrant who comes out of nowhere. So even if those are things that are not right or standing in the way, surely, it seems like something that we can overcome because millions of us are overcoming it. So that excuse of yours just doesn't stand. But the other one, though, makes a whole lot of sense, doesn't it? Because if you're not serious about math, you're not going to be serious about, you know, speaking proper English, whatever. If you're going to be glorifying a thug culture, like, you know, as described by the rap culture and philosophy, you're going to have problems evolving anywhere in this world. Even if I took you back to Africa, where everybody, you know, Black Africa, where we're primarily Black in sub-Saharan Africa for the most part, which is home to 90% of Black people in the world. Even if it took you back to the home of Black people, where 90% of Black people live, you would still have a problem with this attitude. So please quit the nonsense around, oh, it's because I'm Black that I'm not getting anywhere. And so this is why actually I started a show a little while ago, but we stopped it because my dear partner passed away due to COVID. But we had a show called Black Culture Matters. And what we meant by that was Black urban culture matters, because that's where the biggest problem is. And so Bishop Omar, that was his name, Bishop Omar was very, very, very strict about the idea that, my God, yes, you're not making this up. There is a real issue with urban Black culture. I see a child on Monday coming to ask me for advice or trying to talk to him out of things. On Friday, I'm burying the same child. Child meaning 14, 15, 16, 18, because gunned down. Gang violence. He said, I am tired. I am tired of this. He's African-American, and he was saying the same things. And we had a show where we would literally talk about these issues. So for me, it is important we talk about these issues. This victimhood mentality is the absolute worst thing we could do to ourselves. So that's why for me, I look at all of this and it's very clear for me. It's you have two situations, or there's an issue with the seed, and or there's an issue with the environment. And because those things are very clear, New Zealand has a much better business environment than my country. That's why I bring it up in the book. Technically, New Zealand, almost everyone should be thriving. And I am sure there are many Maoris who are doing just fine. But the few maybe who are not are the ones who are voicing, helped by very lefty networks who claim to care about them and are basically shooting them on victimhood. That's pretty much what you have. And this scenario, Marie, is being played out all around the world. All around the world, traditionally dominated people and or cultures are being told that they can't get there because of the dominant factions. And that rhetoric is not even coming from the majority of a dominant faction. It's coming from a very tiny subset that I think has a huge issue with who they are and their identity. But if you think I'm going to let your twisted, misguided, you know, idea about your own identity, whatever issues you're going with, you're going through as a white person, because usually that's who we're talking about, especially white female liberals, whatever problem you have, do not take me down with you. You deal with your own problems. Just don't wrap me into your crap, because that's pretty much what's going on. And I think many more of us, you know, people from these so-called, you know, minorities, we need to really keep our eyes on the ball. We don't have the same problem as this white female liberal. Whatever issue is going on with her, it's her problem. Please do not take me down with you. And so we need to be smart and start paying attention to what we should be paying attention for ourselves so that we can make it to the other side. And that's really my message for minorities around the world. There's enough for us to self-actualize. Get to it and stop bundling ourselves, allowing ourselves to be bundled with whatever mental or whatever issue these liberals are going through. Whatever we're going to have to fix it, but they need to remove us from that equation. We should not allow them to speak for us anymore. We should not allow that to happen anymore. As a matter of fact, here in the US, it's a woman, another one, white liberal woman, who has basically been making this idea popular that expectations, math expectations, is racist. And that's why we're diluting math and removing math altogether from curriculums. Meanwhile, from public curriculums, meanwhile, where do her kids go? Private school, where they're definitely learning math, you betcha. So you see, guys, we have to be smarter than that. I am not willing to be the pawn for somebody. I don't even know what's motivated them, but it should not be my problem. This nonsense and this craziness, they should keep it to themselves and do not rope me into it.
You've covered so many themes that we discuss on the show, and one of the biggest themes is self-agency and the relinquishing of self-agency over to victimhood. One is, what are the key things that are happening now that are keeping people stifled in that place of stifling, number one? And two, who is benefiting from that stifling, and what do you need to do from an individual standpoint to be able, you know, I mean, there's stuff that you can do as an individual, but there's stuff that you need to be aware of. So then you can just sort of go, no, I'm not actually going to do that anymore. I'm going to do this instead. And you're fighting that from an African standpoint. That's a good chunk of what we're doing here, because I'm called a Māori, and I'm continually fighting people on the Māori standpoint who have found that it is more politically profitable to come from a place of critical race theory than in victimhood, that it is actual self-agency and entrepreneurship or flourishing. So,
right.
Let's unpick that thread if you don't mind.
Yeah. When people talk about corruption in Africa, they think that, they think that this thing happens in a vacuum. And I like to argue that it's not. So let me explain what I mean by that. For the most part, so you have two different types of corruptions. You have a corruption that's happening because somebody has the power of a state to sign deals, whether with other nations or foreign companies or multinationals, like maybe the exploration for oil, or the exploration for, exploration for oil, or the exploration for
minerals and gold,
minerals, gas, whatever. And what they're going to do is, in some countries, there is a joke. There's a 20% rule, over 10% rule, over 30% rule. It means how much of it is going to go straight into the pocket of the leaders. And so that's one. Or let's say they're giving a public, there's a market where it's a public offering. Like somebody is gonna get, the road, building the roads or building the hospital, things like that. And then those are public offers. Of course, they usually give it to people that are gonna be also giving them a bribe on the side. And in many places, they don't care actually if you're even capable or not. It's just like, who is willing to give a bribe and be quiet about it? That's it. So you have that side, that type of corruption, which is the corruption that most people think about when they think of Africa, especially think people from the outside world who have never been the day, but they hear things. And, so there's that one. And then you have the other type of corruption where you show up at the passport office, you are Senegalese at the Senegal passport office, you fill out your application, you paid the stamp, which is a way for them to take a fee. You paid for everything, yet your file will never get to be done because somebody is waiting for you to give money. Police officers stop you on the road from point A to point B. You get stopped 20 million times. Each time you have to give a couple dollars. They arrest you. They stop you for all types of things, for which they say, if you don't have it fixed, you cannot continue with the car. They're going to have to put it on the side and pound it. And it's just like a whole nother level of issues that happen, whole nother level of cost and fees. And they know that nobody's going to go through that pain. So you give them a couple dollars and you move on. Some of these reasons can be anywhere from, you have tinted windows. Well, you shouldn't be having tinted windows. Or if you have them, do you have your authorization from the Minister of Interior's office that you can have them? Of course, most people don't know about any of this stuff. And of course, most people don't have it. And it means, well, sorry, then you have to park the car and we're gonna impound it. And you're gonna have to come to the office, pay for us taking the car away, and also the fee, blah, blah, blah. And it's going to cost probably thousands when you add it all together. which this person definitely doesn't have. He's barely making a couple hundred dollars a month. Now you're telling him you have to pay this amount of money. He's like, give $2 and move on. He does that. This cop does it probably with 100 people that day, and he made $200 that day. And he repeats every day. So, but
the great irony of it is, of course, is that in a way is free enterprise of its own, isn't it? Outside of the system. Yeah.
Exactly. So then what happens in this case is so those are the two type of corruptions that are going on. And then people think that's the reason why Africa can't move forward. Me, I have less of an issue with the first one that I described, the one where the government official who has the power to sign deals with foreign corporations and or local, you know, like for market, you know, public offerings. Because that to me, even if I was just calculating this the other day for some friends from RDC, from the Congo, and they're like, yeah, you know, if only they stop stealing all of this money. That's what they mean by that. The corruption, you know, like because you're making deals A at a lower price for the other guy. In exchange, he gives you a little kickback, and everybody's happy. They're happy. Nobody else benefits. And so they're like, so I calculated for this for 2020, and because he was like, this one minister alone was found to have stolen $150 million of our resources. Okay, fine. So I made the calculation based on the population for 2020 and also the entire value, suspected value of natural resources and stuff like that for that country the same year. And I came down to if even a dime of that money was not diverted, how much would it mean for each Congolese? I think we came down to close to $270 or something like that, $270 for that year. Do you really think that's going to get anybody out of poverty? Mm. And even if you took that money and you went and you built the roads and the schools and the stuff that, you know, the government is supposed to spend the money on when they get it, hospitals, fine. You get some great hospitals, you get some good roads, you get some good schools. And don't take me wrong, it's great. But then what? Then what? Where are the jobs besides those few government jobs? Who is making the stuff we're going to eat? Where is the prosperity? No prosperity will be built. And that is under the best circumstances.
So then do they rely, those in governance who have done all of that, do they then rely on foreign aid so then they can assuage that responsibility?
That's the thing. So there they are. The corruption is going on just fine, thank you very much. And so nothing that their national budgets should have done for the people is happening, because the little that they're getting from their people and from the natural resources that they sold on the cheap, even that little, even if it was all fully put towards the country, which it's not, it would still not be enough to really build a prosperous society or to even cater for the needs of the people. And in this case, also what you have is you don't have enough people paying taxes in this case. And I know libertarians hate the concept of taxes, but what I mean by that is even people being able to make enough money to take care of certain things, that's not happening because the people don't have the jobs are not there. So then what happens, the rest of the world looks at it and be like, oh, gee, isn't it terrible? We got to help, which means foreign aid. Foreign aid is government-to-government aid. And so that money flows from rich nations to poor nations. And there again, what do? They pocket most of it. So there, the trick is, I think the people on the ground get maybe, if I'm being generous, 20 to 30% of the money. Maybe another 50% goes straight back to the donor country through all of these aid agencies, right? And then maybe 10, 20% trickles down to the poor people in the country. And if these people come out of poverty, the whole thing crumbles. Because if there's no more poor people, no more foreign aid, no more foreign aid means no more fat cats, you know, in the case of the leaders, no more chateaus in the south of France, no more 10 mistresses that you're taking to Paris or whatever for shopping sprees, you know, during your so-called official missions. Not all of that dries up. And all of these agencies that you see on the US side, on the Western side, them too go drying up. When you see these agencies that are making the money that they're making, having business class flights on a regular basis when they're going back and forth visiting their families, some of them even get this, Marie, get a hardship bonus. Because, you know, it is so hard to live in these wastelands that we are, full of mosquitoes and nasty weather and all that stuff. They're going to be compensated for that harsh life. And they also have, you know, domestics and all, name it. They're living lives that they could not dare to live if they were in the, if they were here, if they were not engaged in that. So you see that whole industry, that's why there is this, documentary called Poverty Inc. It shows that very well. So povertyinc.org, make sure you go to povertyinc.org, because some people who thought they were being funny are trying to do the counter version, because for them, oh yeah, a bunch of free market people, blah, blah, blah again. So they try to do the opposite. So just look for povertyinc.org. So in any case, that's with the corruption, and that's its relationship also to aid. Okay. So when you have all of that, what you have then is no one is paying attention to economic freedom, knowing that economic freedom is actually what's needed to fight the poverty that's plaguing these nations. And one other thing is, and when you talk about economic freedom, and that's probably my third one, it's all of these laws and regulations that stand in the way of enterprise. And so you remember the second corruption I told you about was the one where every time you have to deal with a government official, but there is a rule or a regulation of sort, like if you're going to have tinted windows, you have to have X permission. If you also open the trunk of your car, do you have an extinguisher? Okay, yeah, I have one. Well, you actually need two. Okay. Well, they actually need to be less than 6 months old. See, they're going to catch you at something, right? It's like all of these rules, all of these regulations, all of it. Your tail this, your blah, blah, blah this. So every time the official has the right that's bestowed upon them by a regulation or a rule, it becomes a friction point between you and this person. And whenever you have a friction point, the only way you're going to get away from it is by paying a hefty, hefty, hefty price that you and I know that is not fair and not right. It's not sustainable. If I was to pay along the road to all the points they're going to stop me for something, it's just not sustainable. There's no way. So the only way we can make it through is to give the bribe. Hmm. That's our out of jail card. So that's what people don't understand. And when it comes to business, it's the same thing. We even these cops stopping you from point A to point B, oftentimes our trucks going from point A to the port, you have no idea how many times we get stopped on a small portion of road. It's insane. You would say, my God, why are you doing this? But that's what it is. And so that corruption right there, that stuff right there is a result of too many laws and too many senseless laws. If the laws were not so many of them, first of all, you probably would know them and you would avoid them carefully. You would be compliant. It would be easy. But when there's so many of them, you're probably going to miss something, which means, aha, gotcha. And the only way you get away from this one, pay me something. If not, it's going to cost you a lot and it's going to waste a lot of your time. Your whole day might be wasted today. And you might have to come back tomorrow again to my office to fix this. Mm-hmm. And so you see, or if the price is, okay, it's going to cost you 50 cents because I'm talking Africa, money type. If it's going to cost you 50 cents or even that dollar or even that $2 that I'm giving to the officer every day, I would just, pay the dollar over $2. I'm being compliant. This is not a bribe. That's what it costs literally to have made this infraction. Fine. But right now, that's not the way it is. So I tell people and they're like, oh, corruption, corruption. I'm like, corruption is the sign of too many laws and too many senseless laws. And when it comes to doing business in Africa, it's up and down the street. It's like swimming through molasses to try and do business in most African nations. And this is something that they have in common. So my friends are always upset because like, my God, Africa is a continent. It's not a country. I'm like, thanks for the lesson. But when it comes to this issue, we are a village. Because when you look at the Doing Business Index ranking of the World Bank, except for four African nations, all other sub-Saharan African nations are on the bottom half of the Doing Business. So it means this problem is very real and it's something that we have in common. Just like anywhere you go in Africa, you see the same markets. selling pretty much almost the same things in the same way by the same people.
So who controls that? So, I mean, is that because is it used as a level of control of the people because you've got some people who have got money and power and they do not want that to change? Or is it just a paradigm that's been set over decades and no one like you has come along and challenged it and said, well, no, it doesn't need to be like this anymore and we have the power to change it? I mean, which is it?
Sure. So I think the best way to understand where we are and how we get out of it is to understand how you came into it. So for many of your listeners, I would encourage them to, again, go back and think about the history here. So in the late 50s, early 60s, started a wave of what we called a wave of the end of colonization. So many African nations that had been colonized set out on their journey to becoming so-called free. So no longer colonized. They were going to become free at last. And during that time is also, for anybody who knows their history a little bit, is we were at the height of the ideological battle between two ideologies, the two main ideologies. On one end, freedom represented and defended by Western nations. So we're talking the Western Bloc, facing off with the Eastern Bloc. And those guys defending primarily various forms of statism, right? And this is a time at which, you know, we the world had been co-opted into believing that socialism and communism was working, especially from the Soviet Union. And later we found out, of course, that it was all a lie. People were dying and this stuff didn't work, right? So it was at a time where you had two things going on. You had that ideological battle going on and the two sides looking for influence, and they were looking down south for influence. So looking for Latin America, Central America, Africa, so the global south for influence. And us, we were just barely coming out. We were still kind of fighting for our independences. And so if you put yourself in the shoes, so here we are, us. Think about the African liberators. Think about Jomo Kenyatta. Think about Julius Nyerere Tanzania. Think about those people all over the continent who've been fighting to liberate each of them their countries. And they were working together as well. These two sides are fighting and they're looking for influence. My people are thinking, there is no way we're going to side with you, West, because you're the ones who colonized us. There's no way. So we're taking side with the other side. Also, you have to understand, the Marxists were actually the only people fighting for racial equality in those days. And you also had to understand that you were at a time in life where any serious intellectual was a Marxist socialist. So when you put all of those three things together, you can imagine and understand how at this very critical fork of our journey, we went with the wrong bedfellows. We chose Marxist socialism as our ally. That's it. And we never reconsidered since then. And these ideas are not just ideas in the empty. They get manifested in the type of laws that you put. And on top of that, for African Francophone African nations, France was notorious for supposedly leaving, but imposing their old colonies to also keep things like civil law, which is terrible for business, terrible. So this is how most African nations started their independent journey, having various forms of statism, whether it's socialism or communist. Even the ones who supposedly were not that, like Nigeria, we're hardly, because, you know, there's levels with everything. Which end of the spectrum are you? Yeah, you're telling me you're a capitalist, but you're very much on the area where you're borderline starting to mingle with socialism. So that's the type of capitalism, because they were still doing the five-year plan that was very notorious, you know, in the Soviet Union. So literally, you look at this whole continent, and that's what you had. And we never, never, ever question that. To the point that today I have some rules and regulations that when I ask where, please pull up the code and in which this is, the law. It's pre-colonial dated law. And so this is what happened to us. So when you say, who did this? Was it intentional? It is a way it happened. I don't know if we call that intentional or not, but it's a various circumstances that led us to that place in the first place. But then the issue that I have, and this is why I tell people, we are not poor today because of colonialism. It's because in the past 60 plus years that we have had our independences, for those of us who were never colonized, we could totally have gotten somewhere. Totally, if we had really kept our eye on the ball, understanding that poverty is fixed by prosperity. Prosperity is built by entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurs need an enabling business environment. Done. The countries who try to go for that are getting somewhere. As a matter of fact, Botswana was one of the only, few African nations who had gone that path straight from, independence. Because it happens to be that the ruler of Botswana had been Oxford, if not Cambridge, one of those two, trained lawyer, who really understood the common law. And then he came home and he made a mix of between the best of common law that he got from his British background. He is a Botswanian. This guy was a Botswanian, Sir Tekama. And so he mixed that with the very best of his traditional, background. And then he came up with something really interesting. And Botswana is one of only two countries in Africa that never had a coup, never had a war. But most importantly, Botswana doing much better than any other African nation. I argue that Botswana could probably have done as well, if not better than Singapore, if they only had kept on pushing the envelope in terms of economic freedom. Yeah, so that's my point. So when you say it's all of these people. So then what happened is that. So we never re-questioned it or anything like that. And instead of questioning it, what happened is the rest of the world eventually, because we all know you follow socialist paths, prosperity is not going to be part of your journey, part of your balance sheet. And, so then the rest of the world be like, geez, my God, isn't it terrible? Africans are so poor. Let's send them foreign aid. And when you started doing that, you started diverting people away, the people who should very much have focused on the real solutions. Now you completely started distracting them, and I would say even worse, incentivizing them away from the real solutions. And so with this foreign aid, now the incentives are now actually even toxic. They're counterproductive for me, because you're putting them in a situation where if I make it, the foreign aid dries up. Really? So the incentives now are completely corrupt. So is there happening? What's happening there? On top of that, you have the anti-capitalist bias from media, academia, and Hollywood. So bad ideas come from academia, media launches on it, and Hollywood makes it popular because Hollywood just sucks up whatever comes out of the universities, because they're notoriously from the left. So this is what you have. So today, what we have is, on one end, the incentives are just not there for our people to look in the right direction. Then you have, ambient culture, against what we need, which means no one talks about economic freedom. No one talks about, capitalism. Oh, what's that? It's dirty. So you see how we're cornered from both sides. And our people in the middle of this, many of them are still stuck on the, we're still poor because colonialism. They're being sold the same crap by the same people that, the Maoris are being sold, that the African Americans in America are being sold. It's, again, the same usual suspects, the same actors, the same protagonists of the story. The liberals, under the guise of being our allies and our friends, the people who care about us, but they very much have an agenda, which is very anti-business, anti-capitalist, anti-blob, anti. Now it's anti-fossil fuels. They come and they're very good at telling us all the ways in which these are the movies they promote. They are very good. I mean, have you noticed all the African movie, all the movies related to Africa or Black people that get rewarded in Hollywood? It's primarily talking about slavery. It's talking about all the oppression supposedly that we go through. Even Black Panther, which is on the surface a really positive movie, it's telling them the same crap. that, you know, if only we could keep our natural resources. No one talks about economic freedom in that thing. No one. It's a utopia how prosperity is being built. So you see how our leaders, they're not incentivized to do the right thing. Our people are distracted and kept with anger. That's very much fueled by all of these movies, these books, everything about the black condition. Everything is negative. I mean, you would not be a normal person if you watch one of these movies, whether it's about the slavery or it's about how blacks, you know, were being lynched in the South or being put to jail today for things that maybe whites don't go to. You would be hard pressed not to develop something nasty in your heart watching these things day in and day out. And so that's why our people are distracted in thinking that all of this is happening just because oppression. And so when you say, what is it? I think it would be so great if at least there was a conspiracy on this, but there's none. It's just we've been apathetic about this whole thing. Mm-hmm. So the goal here, and that's why the book, is to really try to set the record straight, get people to put their gaze onto a different horizon. And then from there, the good news is we know then from there how to fix things. We know. And that's why these startup cities we're building, next generation special economic zones with their own law and governance when it comes to business, so that our entrepreneurs straight from the ground get to also benefit from the best business environment in the world, having it straight at home and knowing that anywhere where it's that type of environment is put in place, then the magic of prosperity building happens. Right. So that's pretty much what we're trying to do. So for me, it's not so much that somebody is intentionally trying to do this or that. Are there some actors? Maybe. But my biggest thing is I don't care what people's motivations are until and unless I have done what I think needs to be done and looked at the results. I don't think it's fair, viable, smart to just sit there and keep complaining until the cows come home about something that other nations have proved does not have to be our fate. If Singapore today is richer than its colonizer, ex-colonizer, Great Britain by GDP per capita, then literally anybody else can do it. If China has been able to lift 800 plus million people out of poverty in such a short amount of time, anywhere it can be done. If countries like Vietnam, who have been colonized also by the French, and when they left, you know, bombed the heck out of that place, not once, but twice. And Vietnam is now kicking the asses of many African nations. Come on, give me a break. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, you have a country like Ethiopia that has never been colonized yet, at least among our friends. Back in the days, the joke was, oh, an Ethiopian that has a lot of meat on their bodies, or like it's an Ethiopian that's showing off, because the joke was they're all so poor that they have basically literally skin on their bones, and so they were the poster child of poverty. Ethiopians, a nation that has never been colonized. So if it's because we have been colonized that we're poor today, explain to me Ethiopia. And explain also to me why other nations who have been colonized are out of it today.
Two things that you mentioned there that I'd love to have a look at. One is the special economic zones and your work now. So the other outlier, because you mentioned Botswana in terms of African nations that hadn't had a mass conflict. Of course, Senegal is the other one. And so, yeah, so you have Botswana, who was a British colony, lots of elements of British colonial and common law there. Senegal is a French colony. What are the things now? Is there an environment now for you to be able to look at places like, say, Dakar and create a special economic zone in your homeland? Are you able to start sowing the seeds for that flourishing in Senegal?
Yeah, so Senegal is an interesting case. And this is also another one that I wanted to bring up. We have been sold another Kool-Aid that I feel has been a detraction for us as well. And this is because we, being poor, have to, again, serve as the influence agents for the rich nations. As you and I know, in the West, a lot of the rage is around this concept of democracy. And that's one thing they care about the most. Don't take me wrong. The concept of democracy is a nice concept to go for, except I believe a democracy as we know it, where winner takes all, I think it's a rotten concept, and it's starting to show its limits. I also know that it is something that, you know, it's very big on the list for Westerners. Fine. I like to argue that that is another luxury concern. It's for first world concerns. As if in order to build prosperity, you need democracy. Democracy is a nice thing to have. Don't take me wrong. At least the democracy that I would like to see in my mind, where literally people have really power, like power for the people, by the people, that democracy, whatever you want to call it. I'm more like a Kritarki type of girl, but something that's going to be my next book, where the plan, though, is to update Kritarki so that it can fit modern life, as well as not leave minorities behind, as, you know, traditional Kritarki would do. But there's a lot of other good stuff there. We just need to supplement it with, you know, some of those revisions. And then I think we can have something really cool that's going to be far superior to democracy as we know it. So what I mean by that is they have been spending, the Western world has been always all about democracy, supposedly. This country, you're democratic, supposedly, we're going to help you. And the way we're going to help you, tons of aid. See, it has been the North Star. Never focusing on what is it going to take for your people to be prosperous. But their only thing is democracy, because they thought, again, it's another form of soft war going on between the same usual suspects again. Mm-hmm. China is trying to sell us this idea that, you know, control is everything. The Western nations are trying to sell us that democracy. They want to make their clan bigger, for more protection and control. And, you know, yeah, you get it.
And that's even before you get into crony capitalism, which is another whole conversation. Yeah.
That's a whole other one. So my point is, even there, you see that soft war, that soft power is still at play, and we're still being the pawns of it. And us Africans, we have had to do that, because otherwise, you know, then we get blacklisted. We get, we don't get the aid that our people, you know, now they live on, you know, even if it's only 20%, 10% or 20% that trickles down to them, it's still more than nothing. And so, yeah, that's, and especially these leaders. Oh, you mean I can't have my chateau in the south of France? Yeah. So they're all playing this stupid charade of democracy. And then I sit there. And so instead of focusing on this economic freedom, which, by the way, can live pretty much under any type of political frame, because communist China had to practice economic freedom when they were tired and sick of being poor. They had their SEZs, special economic zones, among the most free market zones in the world. That's how China did it. And so my point is, so instead of focusing on stuff like that, here we are, where it's the most important thing is to be a democracy, whatever that means. And we never focus on the other stuff, to the point that today I think our people think democracy is going to be what's going to put food on the table. Well, Senegal has been one of the most stable democracies in Africa since the independences. We just barely made it, even for this election, but our institutions proved to be very strong. And we finally made it. An opposition party leader guy won on the first try, you know, unheard of. It tells you something is working in my country when it comes to the democratic side, even though it's been very, very roughed by this past president the past 12 years. But my point is, look, with that democracy alone, I would argue, because we still run very like socialist, you know, I mean, on paper, it's a very socialist, you know, way of doing things. Senegal, what does it have to show for it? For all of this great democracy, we're one of the 25 poorest nations in the world. So really, seriously? But our people have drunk that Kool-Aid. So you will see civil societies, you will see the young people, you will see everybody when they go on the street and complain, it's like, we want democracy. If only I could have them say, we want economic freedom. It would be a whole nother ballgame. We want the free markets. Everything would change. But no, we've been spoon-fed with this democracy thing.
What did you call it? The hippo generation.
Yeah, so that's the hippo generation. It's George Ayité, my professor, George Ayité. He was again an economist. We lost him early last year. But George is the one, I was at a TED talk, and George, I was at a TED conference, the first TED Global in Arusha in 2007. And George was there. And I was invited there as one of TED Fellows. We were the first cohort for the TED Fellows for TED. And it was 100 of us, young Africans, because they had identified us from all around the world, on the continent, in the diaspora, and saying, these are people that we believe are doing great things for the continent already, and we believe that given a shot, we'll continue to do good things. And so we were there because of that. And I was an entrepreneur already. I had already, you know, was already building my first company. And then it was amazing for me, amazing. Because until I got there, all I heard about from Africa was aid. And even me, having started a business, I was getting to that place where aid is good, ACE is good, trade is better. That's a big difference from aid is toxic. Everywhere you turn me talk about aid now, I'm like, aid is toxic. Foreign aid primarily, I'm talking about foreign aid. You know, aid is toxic. But then I was like, aid is good, but trade is better. That was, you know, where I was. But then I hear Greg, George, and he was on stage and he was talking. And there were people like Andrew Mwenda, and all these people had in common. They were Africans like me. And they had these accents like me. And, and they were talking a story. They were talking stuff that I haven't really heard being asserted so vividly before. And George was talking about, you know, Mwenda was complaining about, you know, the lack of trade. You know, he was like, trade, trade, trade. So these people were against aid. And George was also against aid. And he was against aid. He was against the people who promoted aid, the people who benefited from aid. He was against all of these leaders of ours who are basically leaving off of aid. And the way they think and their ways of just being like not entrepreneurial at all. These are people, they're like bureaucrats, you know, they're bureaucrats and they're heavy and they're stifled and everything moves like, you know, this and so hard. And he was like, these are the people who have taken Africa where it is today. And the antidote to these people, I'm paraphrasing now, but it's you, the cheetahs. And he was talking to us and he said, you are my only hope for Africa. You are the fast runners of Africa. You are the people who wait for no one, wait for nothing. You're going to take matters in your own hand. You run super fast. You're very smart. You're as equipped as anybody. I mean, this was pretty much, and I've heard myself being written like that before. People using this word called decomplexed. This decomplexed generation of Africans, because we have gone to the best schools in the world, best school in the world. We understand the codes from pretty much, you know, everywhere. I understand the codes in my country, but also when I go to another one. So, and the ones in the West, all of that stuff, you know, we just have this, we're like sitting in this and we also supposedly are the ones who understand trade. And so it was just so fascinating. And so he was saying, you are my only hope. You are the fast runners of Africa. You will be the ones who liberate this continent for real. And you're the ones who are going to build prosperity for Africa. And I really believed it with all my being. I was like, you should have seen me. My eyes were this wide open. My heart was so full that I thought it would explode. I had goosebumps my whole body. I mean, George gave us inspiration and encouragement for a lifetime to fight multiple battles. And that's really what the hippo generation is. It's those guys who are benefiting from the system, don't want the status quo to end. And we are the cheetahs. And when you talk about Senegal, is Senegal a place where I could do these cities? Well, Senegal, we will see with a new leadership. But the previous leadership, I don't know if it's true or not, but somebody said at some point that, you know, they heard about the ideas and but maybe thought that France would never let them do so. Who knows? I don't know. But all I'm saying is that also my country, I think, is too deep into the socialist ways. It's going to need some very, very, very deep reforms that I don't think they're incapable of doing. But all of this just to say, Senegal is not my first, is not the one that I'm spending the most of my time trying to do this in, although my business is in Senegal. But I've been speaking to 6 other nations going on 8 now, and they look much more ready, you know, intellectually, society-wise and everything to make these moves that we're talking about than my country is. So maybe my country will come wave two or wave three of this, but definitely not wave one. Wave one is we have other countries that are much more ready to jump a fence.
Yeah. So if people are listening to this and they're thinking, I really do like the idea of this cheetah generation, obviously there's a book, Heart of the Cheetah, which is available at all good booksellers or Audible options. Where do they find other information in terms of supporting what you're trying to do to free Africa economically and actually break away from that stifling and support that flourishing?
Thank you so much. Yeah, no, definitely to follow what's going on, you can go on my website, magatwade.com. So that's one. And then, of course, my Substack. It's also Magat Wade, my Substack. That's where you find them. Also, all the social medias where I will be speaking more about stuff. When you go on my website, you can go onto the tab called Projects. There you'll see Cheetah Generation. If you want to, you can apply to be part of a Cheetah Generation, which is our insider community. And really what people have to understand is the Cheetah Generation is this insider community where we don't care what you look like, we don't care which country you come from, we don't care which ethnicity you come from. What we care about and what unites us all is that you care about Africa, you believe in Africa along the lines we're talking about. We don't want PD aid or anything like that. You can do nonprofits with us, that's fine, but we want those to be productive nonprofits. So if your nonprofit, for example, is helping somebody to learn English in Francophone nations, which we know when you do that, you're pretty much getting them to be now included in this bigger community where they can get new jobs, you know, online jobs or whatever. So it's really about a mindset of you love and believe in Africa and you believe in the free markets. You believe that's what's going to happen. And it doesn't matter if you come at it from the for-profit or not-profit, but you are definitely, what you're doing is supporting the free markets, you know, for it to work, whether you're helping somebody, you know, like I said, with skills that they can then put onto the market or learning, you know, you see what I mean by that. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting because I am not like against, you know, like people trying to help, but it's like, you know, we don't want people giving a man a fish or even this whole teaching a fish is fine. But we also want more people who are going to be focused on, it's nice to teach people how to fish, but it's even more important to make sure that they have access to the water, to the ocean, or to the river. Because then what they do with their all of the skills they learned, right? And that's the part that people forgot. 80% of the resources and energy is on giving people a fish and or teaching them how to fish. And don't take me wrong, teaching how to fish is great. But then who is working on that last piece, which is the systemic part of it, which is access to the ocean or to the river? So that's what we're doing. And that's what the startup cities are. So people definitely should join the Cheetah Generation because there's a lot of great interactions happening every Friday. We have a call on there for an hour and a half where our community is just the best. I don't know. I'm not saying that because it's ours, but it's just so amazing. That's what I've always dreamed to see Africans do with each other and also with non-Africans. I mean, you see all rainbows of skin color on the Zoom screen when we join in and everybody's showing up with this common love and belief in Africa, and that if only we liberate her, she has economic freedom, her children are going to thrive and the rest of the world will benefit from it. All of these people who, given the right circumstances, would love to come and build with us back home. So if you are one of these people, please join us, like I said. And another thing that's happening, we have this African Development Fund, which is actually the fund that I'm using to do my my exploration work on the continent to kind of... while I'm talking to all of these nations, the goal being to land, more than an MOU with these countries, MOU meaning Memorandum of Understanding. So this is like where you basically, the government said, okay, yeah, we're going to do this. You know, it's not like full-fledged contract yet, but we're going to do this. We're serious. We have done all the homework. So those are the things that people can be part on. And of course, just send me an email. If you have something you want to talk about or you have an idea about, magat@magatwade.com. Very simple. And yeah, so I welcome all great ideas, connections. So it's going to take all of us to do this, but we want to do it in a way that's win-win-win and also seeing it, you know, connecting at an eye level way, not no savior on either side. But we also recognize that, you know, if you want to go somewhere, go by yourself. But if you want to go far, go together. So it's really very much that spirit. Yeah. Mm.
Oh, thank you so much, Margaret. This has been incredibly inspirational. I know our listeners will find it incredibly inspirational. As she said, margaretwade.com. But remember, if you've caught all of those, you weren't able to write them down, our wonderful team at Inbox will have that inbox at realitycheck.radio or 2657 is the text. Flick us a text and we will get that information out to you. Thank you so much for your time this morning. We do greatly appreciate it. And don't disappear. Of course, more great content here to come on Counterculture with Reality Check Radio. Thanks, Margaret.
Thanks, Marie. I really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.